AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Hey y'all, welcome to another episode of Jesse's Fireside Chats. In this episode, I want to give you my thoughts on the U.S.'s interventions in foreign affairs. So, buckle your seatbelts, let's get started. So first, I want to walk through the history of U.S. intervention abroad. And this is going to be, in a nutshell, it's not going to be super extensive, but just to give you a quick rundown, both of military and non-military major events in U.S. history that involved intervention in affairs that were not on U.S. soil. So, the first kind of foreign policy intervention, if you can call it that, was there was a debate over whether the U.S. should help France in its revolution after France helped America in its revolution, because if the French hadn't helped, it's unlikely that the U.S. could have won against Britain. And then you had where the U.S. wanted to send some diplomats over to France, and there was a big brouhaha surrounding their reception and all that, and that was essentially the XYZ affair, which happened during the Adams presidency in 1800. The main reason I'm mentioning it is because it was kind of the first international incident, if you will, that happened in the U.S. after the signing of the Constitution. After the U.S. as we know it had started to be established and was young, you had, I'm not going to go into too much detail about the circumstances that led to the War of 1812, because the War of 1812, the British actually tried to attack the U.S., so, and it happened on U.S. soil, so I mean, I don't really count it here, because I'm mainly talking about foreign interventions in completely foreign affairs or in affairs that did not immediately need U.S. intervention and rare ones that did. So then after that, the next major thing was that during the Monroe presidency, you had what's called the Monroe Doctrine, where basically, Monroe said that the U.S. did not want Europeans to colonize other parts of the Western Hemisphere, that Europe should keep its hands off the Western Hemisphere. It's not a military intervention per se, but it was kind of a threat of one and a stance that was taken. And so I count it here. The next major, completely kind of external thing was the Mexican War. From that, the U.S. gained a big chunk of its territory. I don't really have a firm opinion on that. I don't have a firm opinion on it because on the one hand, a lot of that territory now is definitively, it's been divided into several states that are part of the U.S., and I mean, there's not really a lot of, at least that I've seen, there's not really a lot of outrage about it anymore, other than from some, especially on the left, that that cry about imperialism while also denying the atrocities of the Soviet Union and the end of China. So, I mean, they don't have very much credibility. And I just don't have a major opinion on it. I'm only mentioning it because someone might later claim that I forgot to mention it, or that I didn't think it was a thing. And I don't know enough about the background circumstances that led to it to firmly have an opinion one way or the other, whether the U.S. should have fought in the Mexican War or not. I don't have an opinion. Then you had the Spanish-American War in 1898. The U.S. had been openly talking about imperialism. One of the big voices behind some of that was Teddy Roosevelt. And as far as I can tell, the biggest win from that was that for a while the U.S. had the Philippines as a territory, which is kind of nonsensical because the Philippines are like 8,000 miles, according to Google. And so I think it's kind of dumb for a country to rule a territory that is that far away from it. I don't see why. Because for one thing, if there's any trouble, if that territory resists the rule of that country, the amount of time and money it will cost to send troops over there to quell the resistance could be much better spent dealing with trouble at home, because you're never, as far as I can tell, we live in a fallen world, you're probably never going to have a country that does not have problems of its own. I find the argument made by Thomas Paine in Common Sense to be persuasive, that Britain being 3,000 miles away, what was the sense behind having Britain control the American colonies when Britain was 3,000 miles away? It's ridiculous. Like, God put that ocean there for a reason. He didn't want Britain to rule the colonies, because if he did, wouldn't have a big fat ocean in the way, would ya? I mean, Paine didn't say it like that, but I'm paraphrasing, obviously. So, feel the same way about the U.S. having control over things like the Philippines, which right now, the U.S. doesn't. The Philippines is its own country, but for a while there, the Philippines were U.S. territory. And so then the next thing you had was, you had the, during World War I, Woodrow Wilson, after sending troops to fight in Europe, which, why were we fighting in Europe? Europe is not the U.S., it's not our country. Especially when some historians have agreed that World War I could have been avoided. So then Woodrow Wilson wanted to have a hand in drafting the Treaty of Versailles and creating what was called the League of Nations, and essentially trying to outlaw war, which a lot of that was idealistic nonsense. Why were we putting so much time and energy and money into idealistic nonsense when, again, we had problems at home? Especially considering that it went about as well as you would expect if you paid any attention in high school history class. Because World War I ended in 1918, and 21 years later, in 1939, World War II started up. Now, before that, you had the start of the Depression, which I've given you my theory on the Depression, which was that communists purposely crashed the stock market because they wanted socialism, and they felt that causing a depression of that magnitude would lead to the socialist revolution that they wanted. They'd seen what happened in Russia, and they thought that this would work, and it partially did with things like Social Security. But getting back to the main topic, during the Depression, you had what was called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff, which raised the prices on foreign goods to oppressive levels. And then foreign countries established their own tariffs to retaliate against the Smoot-Hawley Tariff. And so you essentially had an economic dumpster fire that caused foreign trade to nearly grind to a halt around that time, which did not help the situation in some of those countries that were still recovering from World War I. And so then you had World War II, and World War II is the rare case when I think it was justified for the U.S. to intervene. Because, for one, the U.S. was invaded by Japan, and obviously, if you are invaded, and you sit back, and you play dead, and play possum, and hope that the enemy gets bored and runs away, that's stupid. That's insane. No country worth its salt would do that. That's why I don't support completely getting rid of the military, just downsizing it, and not using it as frequently as we do. So, then you also had in the European theater of the war, the Nazis being the Nazis and genociding millions of people. So, I definitely think that it was good for the U.S. to get involved there. I mean, we've all learned about the Holocaust in school. At least, I would hope we have, and if you haven't, that means that your school system clearly failed you. I've also been clear that we need to learn more about communism and its atrocities, and that the gulf between communism and fascism is imagined, because other than a surface-level difference in rhetoric, the two are basically the same. But leaving that aside for a second, yes, I think it was good for the U.S. to intervene in World War II. Now moving on, I do not think the U.S. should have intervened in Korea, because it's not our country. I can sympathize with the anti-communist motives for wanting to do so. I mean, I'm about as anti-communist as you can get. I literally just said that communism and fascism are essentially twins, with only a small difference in the rhetoric that they use, which is skin deep. So, I can sympathize with the outrage, but I do not think we should have intervened. You can be outraged at something without shedding your own blood over it. You can believe that something is wrong without sending troops to try to stop it, especially when it didn't even deliver a conclusive result. I mean, in Korea, you still now have North and South Korea, which were divided that way before the Korean War started. They were divided that way when dividing up Japan's assets, because Japan had conquered Korea and North Korea was given to the Soviets, and the Soviets allowed it to be its own country, but then had a lot of say in how it was run, and so it ended up being communist. And then South Korea was given to the U.S. The U.S. let South Korea be its own country, but had an interest in the U.S. being, or in the U.S., in South Korea being capitalist, not communist. But even still, like, South Korea is not a state. South Korea is not our country. And so I just don't think we should have intervened. I feel the same way about Vietnam. I understand the anti-communist impulses that led to wanting to intervene in Vietnam, but I don't think we should have. I especially don't think we should have drafted men into these wars. I am opposed to the draft because I do not think that the state should force you to risk your life, especially when it's not a dire emergency. Now, if you are being invaded, if heaven forbid the U.S. was invaded and all the, the enemy was conquering us and there was literally no other choice, you had run out of any way to recruit more volunteers, you'd recruited as many volunteers as you possibly could, and you still just could not find enough people to adequately defend the country, and the only alternative was allowing the country to be conquered by whatever enemy was invading us. As a last resort, I can understand having some kind of draft in that case. But that is a last resort emergency option. At least it should be. And so I don't think it should have been used in these wars when the war wasn't even happening in the U.S. It was not even fending off an invasion. It was fighting in some foreign country's war that didn't even directly affect us. Because generally speaking, I do not think that the state should be able to force you to risk your life for it. I don't think that's right. Just like we don't force people to become police or firemen, we don't force people to become electrical workers, we don't force people to become prison guards, we don't force people to become sanitation workers, which can be a surprisingly dangerous job at times. We don't force people to work in construction. You know why? Because that would be almost like slavery. The main difference being you'd get paid, and slaves didn't get paid. That was the whole thing, was unpaid labor. But it would be not much better than slavery. We don't force people to do that. Now, I admire people who choose to defend their country if they are actually defending their country or if they genuinely believe they're defending their country. And I'm not going to deny the service of those who were forced to, and it's not their fault that they were forced. So, I mean, we can still appreciate the service that they did, but that does not mean that it was not wrong to draft them into the war. I admire the services of policemen and firemen and electrical workers and such that put their lives on the line, especially police and fire, to defend the community and keep the community safe and keep daily life running. I guess you could say electrical workers do that in a way because they install and repair and maintain the infrastructure that keeps a lot of things running in our society, including lighting, heating, air, internet, medical systems, including life support systems, refrigerators, etc. They're still not quite as crucial as police and fire directly, but indirectly, they play a big role in our community. That's why I mentioned them. So I admire the service of anyone who is willing to potentially put their life on the line to protect the community and serve the community. But I don't think the state should force you to do that. Generally speaking, the draft should be only a last resort option. And we have not had a period in our history where that was actually the case. Even the war between the states, the draft was implemented on both sides, and in the South, it was more justifiable. Actually, I would say in the South, it was the situation I'm describing, where you're being invaded, you're being conquered, your men are dying off, you've run out of ways to voluntarily recruit them. An invading and occupying force that is conquering your country, and you have no other choice to defend your country. It is life or death. It is an emergency. So in that case, I can understand the draft, even if the draft is not ideal. I mean, usually in emergencies, it's not ideal. That's the reason it's an emergency. But even in the war between the states, I don't think the Union should have drafted men into the fight because, again, the Union was invading and conquering the South, and I don't support that, obviously. And I also think that even then it was kind of foreign because they were being taken away from their own states and their own families to fight far away, sometimes hundreds of miles away. So it's not quite as bad as shipping them off to fight in Japan, but it's not much better. Especially when they're having to fight against, a lot of people will frame it as they had to fight against fellow Americans, but I would say they were having to fight against people who made it clear that they wanted to be independent. They wanted to have their own country. Just like the U.S. wanted to break away from Britain. You didn't have a massive ocean in the way. But I still believe that any state or part of a state that wants to secede from an existing country, not even just the U.S., but any country, any bloc that wants to secede from a specific country, if it's what the people of that area actually want to do, they should be able to for basically any reason. I am very pro-secession. That's why I refuse to say the pledge anymore, because the pledge includes the word indivisible, describing the Union as indivisible, and I cannot condone that, because I do not believe that it is indivisible. To believe that it is indivisible and to believe that places should have a right to secede is self-contradictory. If you support secession, then you don't believe the country is indivisible because you believe it can be divided, or at least that can have parts break away from the rest of it, which I guess is technically a form of division, even if it's not an even split or a violent split, even if it's a peaceful breakaway. And so I think that the fact that people were drafted to fight in Korea and Vietnam makes it even worse. As I said, I can understand wanting to fight communism. I'm as anti-communism as you can get, basically. Especially because I used to be a communist at one point. I can understand. I know firsthand the evil stuff that they believe, and I do not support it, and I think it is my duty to stand up against it. So that's what I do on here. But that being said, I don't think the U.S. should have intervened abroad in countries that are not our own and that are thousands of miles away, especially when, in both cases, you didn't end up with a definitive victory. In both cases, you ended up with, like, not much improving overall, even if you consider a victory to be improvement. Like if you intervene in something, you're supposed to have an end game in mind of what you want to do. I mean, if you see someone's house on fire and you want to intervene, whether you're a fireman or not, if you want to intervene and try to help put the fire out, well, that's your plan. Your plan is to help put the fire out so the house stops burning. So even if I supported, and, you know, in the case of World War II, we had a goal, we had a clear end game in mind. And so even if I supported more intervention in more of these foreign conflicts, generally speaking, you want to have an end game in mind. What are you hoping to achieve by intervening? Like, and the fact that there didn't seem to really be one other than fight communism in both Korea and Vietnam is telling. And it's also one thing to have a plan on paper if you don't achieve it in practice. And in Korea and Vietnam, you didn't really have that kind of success, if you can call it that, that you would have hoped for if you supported intervening. Because essentially, in Korea, you ended up with the same division you had before. You ended up with North and South Korea. North Korea still being communist, South Korea still being not communist. In Vietnam, you ended up with North and South Vietnam. South Vietnam fell. Then you ended up with just one Vietnam that was, I think it became socialist for a while, and I don't quite know what's going on over there now because I don't keep track of foreign affairs as closely as I do domestic ones because I don't live there. That explains kind of my philosophy on foreign policy is, I mean, if something happens, if something bad happens, okay, that's sad, but I don't live there. So I don't follow foreign affairs super closely simply because they're not my concern. I'm sure you've noticed that if you've been a longtime listener. And so, getting back to our timeline here, you had several wars in the Middle East. You had the two most recent wars in the Middle East that happened in my lifetime, and there were, I think, a couple of others before that. I know there's at least one. I think there were two. And other more minor interventions, like in Nicaragua, stuff like that. And not all of them involved sending troops. Some of them involved sending money, and weapons and other resources, which I still don't think we should be doing that. So essentially, the U.S. has intervened in a lot of foreign wars and a lot of foreign governments, and a lot of foreign conflicts, and I just don't think that we should have. And I don't think we should be bailing out other countries' economies. I don't think it was our job to rebuild Europe after World War II. I think it was our job to intervene in World War II, as I outlined a couple minutes ago, but I don't think we should have sent a bunch of money to rebuild. I think countries need to be able to stand on their own two feet. Part of being a functioning country should be that you can stand on your own two feet. I don't think you should have to rely on other countries to function. It's one thing if you have a severe natural disaster and the countries around you help you rebuild it. I specify the countries around you, not countries thousands and thousands of miles away, except in severe extenuating circumstances like the Irish potato famine, for example. I think it was great that countries further away tried to help out in their own ways, but I don't think that a country should be bailed out on a large scale by other countries, especially ones that are not anywhere near them. If other countries want to do that, That's their own prerogative, but personally, I don't support it. Just like I don't think the U.S. should be sending money over to Ukraine. I don't think the U.S. should be sending money over to Argentina. I don't think the U.S. should be sending money over to the Middle East. I don't think the U.S. should be flying planes over and bombing things in the Middle East. I just don't. I don't support that. And I will say, too, that right now, the optics of Trump going over to all these other countries and sending money to all these other countries, while people here at home are uncertain about how they're going to eat next month, the optics of that are not great. I'm not a liberal, but I also do not hitch my ideology and my beliefs to a person, and so I am not afraid to say that I don't think this looks great. Why are we building ballrooms while others are starving? And I understand there are starving people all over the world and even here in America at any given time, but especially right now, when millions of people are starving or facing starvation, possibly to one degree or another, it just doesn't look great. I understand if the timeline was pre-planned, but even still, the fact that nobody's even addressing this is concerning. And I've been clear too that I don't think that things like food stamps should exist, but right now they do. And if we were going to phase them out, I don't think that suddenly pulling the ripcord is the best answer. I think there should be a more graduated system where, okay, we say in 20 years we're phasing this out. Then we warn people again, okay, in 15 years. And then again, in 10 years we're phasing this out. 5 years we're phasing this out. And then every year after that. So then people have plenty of time, communities have plenty of time to figure out how they're going to help these people, and the people themselves have plenty of time to plan how they're going to get what they need. Because a lot of times sudden changes like that are not always the best answer. So I acknowledge that some of what I'm saying is going to sound unorthodox compared to others on the right, but I don't care because I don't hitch my ideology to a person. This is my show and this is my perspective. And so you're free to disagree with me. In fact, I would encourage you to do your own homework, do your own research, think for yourself, listen to what I'm saying. Obviously, I'd like to have people listen to this. That's the whole reason I'm doing it. But I don't want you to just think, oh, she said it, therefore it must be true. No, I want you to do your own research because I think it's dangerous when people hitch their entire worldviews and their entire sets of beliefs to a human who is flawed, who is fallen, who is not going to be able to, who's not omnipotent, who is not who is not always going to say the right things, who will say things out of their flesh at times, and who won't always have all the answers, because the only one who truly has all the answers is God. He is the King. He is omnipotent. He is without sin. He has all the answers. So the only one who is able to truly be relied on for all things is God. That's why I say too that God is the only one who can handle absolute power, which is why I don't support an absolute dictatorship and giving government too much power. Because only God can handle the amount of power and the amount of responsibility that comes with that amount of power. So where was I? The other thing I wanted to mention real quick is my thoughts on the treatment of foreign terrorists. Now, anyone with a brain knows that terrorists are incalculably evil. At least the acts that they do are incalculably evil. Terrorism is incalculably evil. It often involves killing innocent people and sowing fear for no justifiable reason. The reasons they do give are tied to agendas that not only are extreme, but that you can already not persuade a lot of people to adopt, and so you are desperate, and so you are seeking to shock and scare people into submission. Because if you could attract followers to your agenda without using those means, then anyone, any rational person would do so. And so the fact that some of these terrorists, or the fact that terrorists in general, feel the need to be terrorists and to use these violent means to try to spread their message, either means that terrorists are not rational, or that terrorists support an agenda that is so extreme and so violent that they cannot use more rational means to spread their message. I think it's both. So we can all agree that terrorism is evil and these people should be punished. However, comma, terrorists were still people made by God, even if they don't serve him or they use his name in vain. Even if they do evil things, God will ultimately be the judge. That does not mean that I don't think terrorists should be punished. I do. But I do think they should receive the same due process that others, other criminals, are entitled to. And so I don't support taking them out with drone strikes and sending them to Guantanamo without sufficient due process, executing them without trial. I don't support that because no matter how evil they should still be entitled to due process and a trial. Because if we're going to claim to be fair and just, that is what we should do. And God tells us that we need to be just. And I think that it is unchristian to just execute people without a trial. I said the same thing. Obviously, newborn babies couldn't be more innocent if they tried. And that even includes, in fact, that even more includes preborn babies in the womb. We all have original sin, but beyond that, preborn, unborn babies, they are the most innocent among us because they have not had a chance to commit any sins of their own. We all have original sin from Adam and Eve, but they have not. Unborn babies have not committed any sins of their own. So, let alone crimes. They can't have committed any crimes. And so, abortion is essentially giving them a death penalty for a crime that they did not commit. And I've said before that when you abort an unborn baby, you are executing someone without giving them a chance to know their charges. They haven't even had a chance to commit a crime other than inconveniencing you. But anyway, you're executing someone without giving them a chance to know their charges, to face their accuser, to receive the representation of an attorney, to be questioned about their side of the story, about the crime that they have committed, or the fact that they don't believe they've committed a crime. They are denied the chance to have a trial, whether a bench trial where only a judge is involved or a jury trial. They don't have a chance to appeal the sentence, because even though appeals shouldn't last for 20 years in actual, like, death penalty sentences, I still think you should have at least the chance to have an appeal, because there could have been an error and there could be new evidence that comes out. It's unlikely, but it could happen. So when a baby is aborted, they are executed for no crime that they could have actually committed. And also, even if they had somehow committed a crime, they have not received any due process. And I think that all people who are facing the death penalty, especially, any sentence really, but especially the death penalty, you should have to make sure that they receive sufficient due process. And so even though terrorists, unlike the unborn babies, are guilty of committing some of the most evil acts known to man, they should still be entitled to a degree of due process. If you commit a crime in a foreign country, let's say you go to France and you kill someone, obviously, that's not great. You shouldn't do that. But let's say you do. And then let's say you somehow manage to not get arrested over there. You come back here. France should have the right to extradite you over there. And you should have to face the consequences of your actions. You should have to... I don't know a ton about France's legal system, per se, but you should have to have some sort of trial, some sort of opportunity to face your accusers and see the evidence against you, and possibly, I don't know if their legal system allows this, but possibly to testify against, or to testify that you believe you are innocent. You know, you should have some level of due process. I acknowledge not all countries offer that, but I believe that it should be a thing. And so, similarly, if a terrorist who is from another country is committing atrocities against, especially against Americans, then what should happen is, they should be able to be extradited here, face the charges against them, have the due process that the Constitution outlines, etc. They should not be able to just be taken out without a trial. A drone strike is not a trial. It is just a means of executing someone without a trial. And so I don't think that's right. I think that you should have to give these people some level of due process. Because even though they've committed some of the most evil acts known to man, they are still human. They've still been made in the image of God. And so I support punishment for their evil deeds, obviously. I don't think we should just not punish them. And I do support the death penalty. for certain heinous offenses. I've been very clear on that, and I still, I'm still a supporter of the death penalty for some of those crimes, especially ones that involve murder. But you should still have to face some modicum of due process. We shouldn't just be able to take you out without a trial. That's not right. That's not just. And so those are my thoughts on that. I still think that if you are a murderer of any kind, whether it means you abort a baby, you help someone abort a baby, or whether it means you shoot a man in the head, or you commit a terrorist attack, whatever it is, if you're a murderer of any kind, you should still receive the death penalty. We should take you out to a tree, tie you to that tree, and just leave you there. And that should be the death penalty. I've done a whole episode where I explain why that would be the best method. You can go back and listen to it if you'd like. But I still believe that that's what we should do. But before we do that, you should have 90 days to appeal. And before that appeal, you should be able to receive your sentence in a courtroom, you know, after you've had a trial where the judge or the jury or both have determined that you are guilty based on the evidence, not just based on testimony, although testimony can be evidence or can be a part of the proceedings. And so those are my thoughts on that. I understand they're a bit unorthodox when it comes to a lot of people on the right, but those are my thoughts. I don't hitch my ideology to any particular person or group. This is my show, so this is my perspective. And again, I encourage you to do your own homework. Decide what you think, not to just hitch all your beliefs to what I think, because I am not God. I am flawed. Only He is perfect. And so with all of that out of the way, thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode or considered it to be food for thought. Thank you so much. For passing this along to people that might be interested. And if you haven't done that yet, please do so. Please pass this along to anybody you know that might be interested. You can find this podcast on Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, the RSS feed, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Pandora. You can also contact us on our Facebook page at Jesse's Fireside Chats, and on X at JFSC Pod. You can also email us if you'd like, jessesfiresidechats@gmail.com. That's JESSEAS, firesidechats@gmail.com. You can also leave a small donation if you'd like at our Ko-fi page. So that's KOFI.com/jessesfiresidechats. You can also feel free to reach out if you'd like to be a guest. We would really appreciate it. And with all of that out of the way, thank you so much for listening and have a blessed day. Hope you'll come back next time.